Hello, this is John Cronin. Today we're going to do a podcast on how to sell your patent or patents, winning the game while others lose through sheer lack of knowledge. And this is part two. Welcome back to Invent Anything. Coming up, discover in part two how patents can be sold by highlighting unique qualities related to the patents. You will learn about best things to avoid. You'll learn about best practices. You'll learn how to leverage and overcome invalidity arguments. You'll learn about a little-known marketing of selling to small companies. Lastly, we'll discuss automation of the sales process that you should consider following.
Inventions keep the world spinning. From fire in the wheel to today's high-tech, inventions power change. Turn your inventions into reality. Learn how to get your ideas to market. This is Invent Anything with John Cronin.
Today we'll cover six topics. The first topic is the top 10 things you should do to actually avoid doing in trying to sell your patents. The second topic would be the top best practices to improve the chances of a sale. The third topic would be talking about how you can use evidence of use of infringement to help sell your patents. In topic number four, we're going to move on to what happens when a buyer claims your patent is invalid. Then we'll move to topic number five, which is consider selling to small companies your patents, because it's an unknown market to most companies that they can do that. And I'll tell you the reasons why it's an opportunity. And then finally, topic number six, we'll talk about using the power of automation and how important that is to try to sell your patents. And as before, we will then wrap up. What I'd like to do is spend a few seconds talking about the type of audience for this podcast, the types of people I think that might be interested in this, and maybe you're one of those audience members. For those who want to sell their patents, obviously, even if you have some experience, this is for you. I've had decades of experience in the patent space. I ran a licensing company for a number of years. We did hundreds of transactions, some in the hundreds of millions, some for hundreds of thousands. So we have a lot of experience in selling patents. So this is really coming from, you know, knowledge on the road, so to speak, road hardened. A second audience might be those who are looking to consider whether or not they should sell their patents, because the consideration, right, is to understand what's forthcoming. A third thing is how to prepare to sell your patents, which is absolutely fundamental, sort of a checklist of items. So if you're looking for that, listening to this podcast in part one and part two is for you. And those who are actually who are developing patents with the idea that you want to sell your patents down the road, these podcasts are really good for you because it will give you the opportunity to figure out how to improve your patenting, you know, to get it ready for sale. And that's really great to do it that far back. Also, for all my inventor friends that are writing patents up, I believe I have about 1,600 patents myself, last count. And I know firsthand that if you know about licensing or selling patents, you can do a great job of writing your own patents or working with counsel to do that. And finally, for those who might be buying patents, that's the other side of the coin, right? You might be interested to know what people are trying to do to sell you patents. And so you could really understand that as a way to improve your negotiation. But either way, whether you're selling or buying, the idea of selling your patents in the market is a great topic, and I hope you take a lot back from it. This is John Cronin from Invent Anything. Get ready. We're going to have a journey here. We're going to talk about patent sales and where we uncover the secrets to successfully sell your patents. We're going to talk about how you maximize your value. We're going to talk about how to avoid legal complications for establishing clear title. We're going to talk about things about the essential guidelines for a seamless transaction and discover how maybe inventing around your own patents or filing multiple additions to your patents or creating connection inventions or bridging the gap between your portfolio and the buyer are things that could give you great opportunities in selling your patents. So stay tuned. Avoid the pitfalls and get ready to improve your chances of selling your patents. So let's get into it. Let's talk about topic number one, the top things to avoid, absolutely avoid when you're trying to sell your patents. Now, this comes from experience because I've done deals where they just didn't go and learned the hard way many things that don't work. So this is road-hardened information. The first thing is, if you're going to sell your patents and you don't have clear title, you might as well forget it. Why? Because let's just say that somebody wants to buy your patents or license them. If they do their diligence, they're going to investigate, do you have clear title? Was there a good assignment between the inventor and the company? And what's happening here is you really can't sell a piece of property, real estate, right, unless you have the title, which is why they do a title search. So if you're starting off, get this fixed. It's extremely important. Another thing is really avoid trying to sell patents that have a limited expiration date. In other words, if it's only got 2 or 3 years left, unfortunately, it's so difficult to get value out of patents, and I don't care how good they are. Even litigation-grade patents. Because what happens is, if it's not a lot of time left, by the time you do a deal, they want to sell the patents, by the time they implement the patent, you know, to be able to basically create a product or service around it, basically there's not much time left at all. So unfortunately, if you waited to 2 or 3 years left, you're really limiting your chances of selling a patent. A third thing is, and this is kind of interesting, you should avoid approaching buyers who haven't bought patents before. Now, you would ask, now, wait a minute, how do I know if they've bought patents? Well, there's a lot of tricks to the trade here. I mean, for instance, you could get on the patent databases and look at the potential buyers and see if they have patents and then see if they bought patents from somebody else because you could see change of assignment. There's all sorts of web crawls and tools and techniques we use to see if that buyer is sophisticated. Now, why would it make sense to do this? Because if it's the first time a buyer has ever been approached to buy a patent, they have to develop all the internal processes to analyze it, to do the diligence, to figure out what the price is. So it's so much better, if you can, to find buyers who've already bought patents because they've previously established the prerequisites in their company of why to buy and how to do diligence. Another thing, number four here, is avoid buyers that don't have any money. Once again, why is that important? Well, everyone is going to get very excited, but the problem is they don't have money. So how are they going to buy your patents, right? Even if it's hundreds of thousands or millions. So how do you do that? Well, there's plenty of ways to do it. You could look up market caps of companies. You can look at their balance sheets. Some would have it. You can follow the news articles about investment and things like that. So you can actually, in the negotiations when you're talking about your patents, actually test their wallet. See if they have a treasury that's available to buy patents right in the front end. So avoid buyers that don't have funds to buy patents. Makes sense. I mean, you wouldn't be going to a car lot to buy a car if you didn't have enough money in the bank to buy the car, right? Number five is avoid buyers that basically don't have their own patents. Now, this may sound kind of crazy because you would think that one reason why a buyer would buy your patents is because they don't have the patents. But once again, like before, if the buyer doesn't have sophistication in having their own patents, justifying to them that they have to buy patents from you is much harder. Now, number six here is so important, I could do a podcast or two on it, and I believe I will at some point. And that is avoid anything to do with the declaratory judgment. So when you sell your patents, what you do not want to do is have the buyer, the potential buyer, basically turn around, close the door on you, take you to court because of a business interference litigation tort against you. Now, what does that mean? Simply, it means that somewhere in the negotiations, you told the buyer, potential buyer, that they're violating your patent. Well, that's the language that you would use to make them very afraid that they're going to get sued. And so what they want to do is they don't want a business that has that risk associated with it. So once they hear that, a lot of companies will turn around and sue you for a declaratory judgment to get a proof from the judge that you're not violating the patent, that they're not violating the patents. So do everything you can to avoid declaratory judgment. Number seven, avoid potential buyers that don't have a headquarters in your patent's country of origin. So if your patent is in the U.S. and you're trying to sell to a company whose headquarters are in Italy, you've got a real problem, okay? Even though they might make and sell patents, to make and sell products for the patents that they want to buy in the U.S., chances are, if they're Italian-based headquarters or a non-U.S.-based headquarters, they don't know all the laws associated with the U.S. because they're not working in it. They don't know the markets in the U.S. They don't know a lot of that stuff. So it's a big hurdle to overcome to try to sell patents if the buyers are in another country than the patent you're trying to sell. Another thing you have to come to grips with, number nine, is avoid trying to sell patents whereby you don't want to sell know-how. And what we mean here is that when an entity buys patents, they're very interested in not only the patents, but the information behind it, the data, the prototype, the people, the know-how. So if you're not willing to let that go, it'll be very difficult for you to sell your patents, because almost anybody that buys patents wants as much knowledge, much help as they can to make those patents work. Number nine is avoid selling patents with inventors no longer in your company. I can tell you all sorts of problems with inventors that are basically not in the company, and even worse, like in number 10, renegade inventors who basically don't like the company. And so eventually the inventors of the patent can come into the legal case for the new buyer. So avoid inventors that are not with the company or renegade inventors. Now let's get into topic number two, how to sell a patent and 10 best practices that will improve your chances for a sale. The first thing is, for the patent you're going to sell, is attempt to invent around your own patents and file added provisionals. Now, we do have a podcast on inventing around that process, and you can learn from that. So if you follow that podcast, you recognize by inventing around your own patent, you have strengthened your patent, because many times a company, when they're looking at a patent, may think that they don't need to buy your patent because they can invent around it. So if you invent around your own patent and provide those inventarounds as applications as part of the sale, basically you cut them off with that objection. Another thing, number two, is you can invent on top of your patent and file numerous additions there, meaning instead of inventing around the patent, you ask yourself, what's the next step of this patent? What am I going to do to improve the manufacturing process? What am I going to do to improve the efficiency of this patent? So these improvement inventions, you can brainstorm and file more improvement inventions on top of your patent. So now you're presenting the argument to a buyer that you have patents with all the improvement patents in place, and that raises the value. Now, note, they don't have to be issued patents. They can be filed as provisionals to make the same case. Another thing you can do to raise the value here is to develop key trade secrets that go along with the patent, and even document those trade secrets, that internal know-how we talked about. So if you could provide, here is my patents, but here is the know-how behind it, and I have those documents, that will help your case. Number four, create a working prototype. Nothing is better than showing that it works. Believe it or not, in some cases, if you have a patent but don't have a prototype, sometimes with some small amount of money, you can develop some sort of a prototype, particularly if it's software or some easy product that could be made. So create a working prototype, and that will help the sale of the product, the sale of patents, if you have some sort of real working prototype. One of the things you want to do here in number five is create a connection invention or two between your patent and the buyer's products. And what we mean by that is, if you're making a better cup and this company's going to integrate that cup into their product line, they may sell lids, and maybe the lids they have to develop for the cup you've invented might be different. So create the connection inventions so that they know how it's going to connect into their business. Another thing you can do to improve your chances for selling your patent is number six, which is to present a list of future directions for your patents. Nothing is better for the potential buyer than to chat about all the potential new things you could do with this patent, new markets, new product derivations, etc. So thinking about that ahead of time and preparing a list is a very powerful thing in order to improve the chances of sale. Now, one thing that is many times overlooked is the recognition, like in number seven, to review the patent office file wrappers and address objections up front. See, when a patent goes to the patent office and the examiner gets it, they almost always object to patenting it for a number of reasons. And then through the patent office discussion, which is all documented between the patent attorney and the examiner, you see all the objections to patentability that eventually will overcome in your patent. Understand that, because almost always when someone's going to spend, you know, some amount of money for your patent, they're going to hire a patent attorney to go through the file wrapper, and questions are going to come back. So understand your file wrapper before you try to sell the patent, and don't be surprised if that information is going to be debated. One thing we found, and this is kind of interesting, and this is number 8, is to develop a compelling short video, almost a sales package, if you will, which describes who you are and why you're selling your patent and a little bit about your personal history and also about the patent and sort of what it covers. Maybe talk about the claim a bit, but talk about what it can do. A 2-minute video of this is really helpful in a sales package, because if you have a little write-up that you're sending to somebody, they can click on the link and they can get to know you, the person, and your story. You're adding the personalization to your patent. And people love a good story. As a matter of fact, sometimes these videos that we've made end up winning the day to get us through the gatekeepers and having basically the buyer feel like they're your friends because they want to help you. And believe it or not, I've seen these relationship forms between buyers and sellers. So make a short video. Number 9, what you could do is highlight the market potential by doing some level of evaluation. In other words, there's expert help on this. My firm does valuations all the time, and other firms do. But if you can either find a firm to do that or try yourself to figure out what the total market is and the apportionment of your patent in that market and assume some, average royalty rates and so on, figure out what you think the value of the patent is, at least from a licensing perspective. When they buy it, they might buy it less than the licensing value because you could license to many and they're only one entity. But at least get a round number of what you think this is worth. I was on a phone call last night at 8 o'clock in Korea, and I'm helping a client sell a patent. The third question that they came out was, what's your expectation for a sale? Because we previously worked it out, I could use this, mid-8 figures is what I said. And they were very surprised because that's a pretty big number. But then they asked me to justify it, and I was ready to do that, which I did. So all of a sudden there was silence on the other end because we knew the value and we could back it up. Now, number 10 is rationalize the cost of obtaining the patent to the buyer. Now, obviously there's cost to the patent attorneys, the patent fees and things like that. I'm not talking about that. I think everybody would know that. But a lot of times patents are the result of many millions of dollars of investment into the company, right? And the result of many trials and error to get to the point where it worked. And maybe the company didn't work out, but maybe it was an invested capital of $15 million, of which these 3 patents, for instance, was the result of that. Therefore, you can really talk about the value of your patent from how much was invested in it, and that's an important point. So we could go on and on about ways to improve things. So let's go on to the next topics coming up. Learn about selling patents using evidence of use for infringement, or a way to sort of figure out and maximize the patent value. Learn pervasive claim charts could be the way to go, or how to demonstrate unauthorized use of your technology as proof of its market relevance. Maybe we could talk about the strategic benefits of declaratory judgments once again and trade secrets. Maybe you can figure out through this next section how to gain negotiation leverage, how to ignite kind of a bidding war, how to showcase proven markets about your technology, and most importantly, how to overcome challenges when facing prior art claims. And don't miss, when we start talking about this, how to use evidence of use of infringement to actually improve the chances for the patent sale. We'll be right back. So let's get into topic number 3. It's actually one of my favorites. It's called How to Sell Your Patents Using Evidence of Use of Patent Infringement. Now, evidence of use, something I'll explain quickly. Just as a background here, my firm does evidence of use for clients all the time, 2 or 3 a month, and we've been doing that for 2 or 3 decades. So we have a lot of experience in what is evidence of use. Although we don't practice patent law, we do the technical work behind evidence of use. But what is, in number 1 here, on the topic number 3, what is evidence of use? Well, evidence of patent infringement means that you can prove by looking at your claims and by matching it up to the client's product or service, that they're the same. So you can literally show a table to essentially show, here are the elements of your patent claim or method steps, and here are the elements of the buyer's method steps or elements as well, and you line them up. Getting information about your client's products or the buyer's products or services many times it's just derived by the website of the buyer because they have this information. But many times our clients actually go get the product and take it apart with the service and try to do some investigation work. But, you know, if they have evidence of use, you have to be very careful because you don't want to say you have evidence of use. And there's a way, a trick here that we can use to get the same point across without saying that we have evidence of use for infringing, because that would be a declaratory judgment opportunity, which we just talked about. On the other hand, as I mentioned, a deal I've been working on, in one deal I'm working on, the client, the buyer, actually asked if we have claim charts against their product. And we did. And under NDA, we passed them. So in that case, getting a declaratory judgment would probably be the right thing because they asked for it, okay? And it's our opinion of what the claim chart is. So evidence of use is proof of the patented technology being used by the potential buyer. Now, number two about evidence of use is the importance of using it to sell patents. What I mean is, if you have evidence of use, that shows tremendous credibility of why they need the patent, right? Because if they're doing it, and you believe they're doing it, then that's much better than trying to sell a patent whereby they may need to adopt it. I came into this thinking, I haven't coughed in a week, and this should be a breeze.
I just hope you're not allergic to me.
Yeah, I could be.
Yeah. My wife sometimes says that she's allergic to me. Yeah.
I can go right to number three.
Okay. Here we go. When you're ready?
Yep.
All right, anytime.
And number three is a derivative from this, which is talking about declaratory judgment again. Now, we talked about declaratory judgment before by mentioning don't say to the potential buyer that they're infringing your patent. That was how we brought it up before. But now we're talking about declaratory judgment in a slightly different context because you have done evidence of use. So you actually know that they're filing your patent, and you're trying to get them to see the evidence of use, right? So you're getting closer to a declaratory judgment. So you have to be very careful here. I mentioned if they request it, which is great, that's under NDA. So very rarely would anybody get a declaratory judgment if the other side requested claim charts, etc. But here what we're trying to do is to try to get the buyer to understand the value of your patent through this evidence of use. One way to do this, and I mentioned there was a trick, and this is number four, called the seller's black box. At IBM, when we were at IBM, this was called the IBM proof package. That basically what we could do is to show our patent claim and then show a picture of our product, showing how our product and our patent claim link. So our claim links to our product. Then we would show the competitor's product, the company that we're in trying to sell the licensed patents to, and would show our product picture to their product picture. Now, since we link their product picture to our product picture and then our product picture to our claim, there's a relationship that shows evidence of use, but it's not direct. So we've never got a declaratory judgment doing this. I call it the seller's black box. You take your patent, wherever it is, in their process or their system, and basically take their process or their system and draw a black box in that part and say, we don't know what you do, but what we do would make that black box work really well. So in essence, you put your patent inside their black box and avoid totally this whole idea of declaratory judgment. One of the things about evidence of use is that it can really leverage, in number five here, leverage the evidence of use for competitors' trading cards. So in some cases, when we try to sell a patent to a company, we may find evidence of use of our patents to the competitor of that buyer. So now we have a great opportunity to explain that we have evidence of use of our patent in your competitor. And this would be a great reason to buy it, our patent, because it could be used as a trading card. And we've done a lot of deals like that. So finding evidence of use, either for the potential buyers or the competitors, is really important. I talk about claim charts. I could probably do a whole podcast or two on claim charts. Once again, this is an art. there are people that do clean charts very well, and others that do clean charts, quite honestly, it's hard to get the point across to see how it would connect the claim to the product. So claim charts, once again, is the claim of your invention listed in a table, and on the other side is the product or method steps of the buyer's product or service. So claim charts are normally known in the industry. All claim charts are not created equal. So we would suggest if you're trying to sell your patents what you think is evidence of use, get really decent claim charts. One of the things in number 7 is that when you have evidence of use and you're presenting evidence of use to a new client that might want to be the buyer, then what you're doing is automatically having them recognize that they need to have a good freedom to operate process. Meaning, if this is the first time that your patent is showing up to this buyer and they didn't know about your patent, that basically tells you that they never had a freedom to operate process on their product. In other words, they developed the product, put it out, and never did a patent search. So when you do an evidence of use and then you're delivering that to a potential buyer and they get surprised by it, you automatically know they do not have a good process for freedom to operate, which generically then means they probably don't have a lot of other safeguards in their system to guard against patents like yours. So you've learned something if they are surprised by your patent. And then you can leverage this freedom of operate with them, saying, since you hadn't done a freedom to operate, this certainly will help you understand where our patent fits and maybe other patents fit. One of the things that happened, and this is topic number 8, is the negotiation power through evidence of infringement is really high. As I mentioned before, I got evidence of use, and you're using my patent, and you're the buyer, I have a hell of a lot of negotiation power. And that helps an awful lot in making a deal happen. Because at the end of the day, you could always sue them, right? And they know that. So this is really important. In number 9, we want to increase the value of our patent to the buyer by creating a bidding war. So I really like to approach a potential buyer of a patent, particularly after I have other potential buyers of the patent. As a matter of fact, I will stage this on purpose. I will get a buyer very early interested at the highest level that there's some interest. And then I find another buyer, basically this bidding war, that becomes interested as well. Now I can mention to the second buyer that I have a potential first buyer that has interest. I never have to get involved into how much interest it is. So I always like to keep competitor bidding around. And never dishonest, but it's all in negotiation, right? So if someone knows that there's another party bidding on this patent, they may up their indication of speed and value to buy your patent. Number 10 is using evidence of use is that basically whether it's evidence of use against them or evidence of use against their competitor, it really shows that your patent has established market precedent, right? That your patent is actually being used in the market. And that, of course, is a great big check mark about the value of your patent. And finally, in evidence of use number 11 is what you can do is have enhanced due diligence for informed business decisions. You see, you can have that purchaser engaged in a more exhaustive due diligence process because I could tell you the difference between having evidence of use or not is the buyer, if there isn't evidence of use being talked about, the buyer will do some level of due diligence. On the other hand, if the buyer knows there's evidence of use, they will do a tremendous amount of due diligence. So what you're doing is, through the very nature of saying there's evidence of use, whether you are right or wrong, to 100%, gets them to do a lot more due diligence, which is really what you want to do. So this evidence of use is great to make the value go up and to get the buyer to do more diligence, which is what you want them to do. Let's change the subject and go to topic number 4. How do you sell your patents when a buyer claims that your patent is invalid? I mean, you might think this is the end of the world if you're trying to sell your patent. So the first thing is just quickly, what's the definition of prior art? And how could prior art be used to invalidate your patent? Well, if the buyer basically reads your patents or patent and says, I have these 4 patents I found, or I have this article I found, and they describe your invention well before you filed your patent. If that was the case, the patent office wouldn't allow your patent to be issued. On the other hand, if it happens after your patent issues, then that information could be brought to the patent office in terms of re-examination to invalidate your patent. So it's a challenge. So first of all, prior art is always brought up in a patent sale transaction. And it's a negotiation tactic a lot of times. So the idea is to understand what their prior art is and be able to debate that with them. You know, basically this is a challenge. And number two, the challenge is that the buyer claims that they have prior art. And sometimes the buyer will tell you what the prior art is and sometimes they won't. But that challenge, expect that challenge is going to come. Now, what do you do to get ready for that? Well, before you sell your patent, not only did you do prior art in order to get your patent, you know, with the examiner, but it might be worthwhile doing a second prior art search before selling it. Because a lot of times, doing prior art to get a patent, the prior art search you're doing might be very different than doing a prior art search to sell a patent. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of prior art that a buyer will abstract up to tell you that you're violating it so they don't have to buy it. So doing another prior art search right before you sell is a very useful thing to understand currently. A lot of times, by the way, prior art or patents might not have been laid open by when you try to get your patent examined. A year or two later, you got your patent, and some other prior art was opened up that was before your patent. Nobody's looking at that, so your patent isn't invalid yet, but the person you're selling it to may find it. So there's a lot of good reasons to look at the prior art before you sell your patent. One of the things about this is, number three, is to investigate the source of assertion of prior art, meaning if it's a patent and it's prior art, that's a robust piece of prior art. It's easy to understand exactly what the patent is, reading the claims, etc. But if it's a paper or a journal or some website, a lot of people would abstract that information up and say that's prior art. And it's extremely debatable whether a paper or a website or a picture of a product really should be considered prior art. A lot of thinking would have to be done. So consider what the assertion is. If it's another patent, it's probably a good assertion. If it's something else, I, when I negotiated, would almost totally discount it. I would say, if that product is a violation, would invalidate my patent, what does that product claim look like? Because you have to get this specific. One of the things we want to do in terms of this prior art, and number four, is to evaluate the type of prior art, which I just mentioned. Sometimes the prior art is vague. Sometimes the prior art is very specific. Sometimes the prior art is very direct, and sometimes the prior art is somehow related. So look at the prior art and try to figure out what type of it is, and then know what kind of assertion it is. In any case, when you're trying to sell a patent and prior art is brought up, strongly would recommend number five, which is make sure you get legal opinions on your end. One of the key things is the buyer using a patent attorney on their end to provide the prior art and make an opinion? A lot of companies will have the CEO or the CTO say they found prior art and they're negotiating that they have prior art. The way that I shut that down with an objection is I ask the CEO or the CTO if they're a patent attorney. And of course they say no. So then I say, you know, only a patent attorney has the credentials to look at the prior art with the patent office or their client. So prior art and patent claims and understanding it is the practice of a patent attorney. So by you, the CEO, saying you found prior art doesn't mean anything to us. So by doing that, it's a strong pushback against the objection. No matter what happens in number six, you should always disagree with the buyer's position on prior art. Meaning at the end of the day, you shouldn't come up and say, yep, you're right, this is prior art. This would invalidate my patent. Prior art given to you maybe something where you then have to turn around and provide that prior art back to the patent office because you learned of some new art. So get a legal opinion here and be very careful, but I would never agree with the buyer's assertion of this prior art. One thing about prior art is it helps you understand how they're going to leverage your negotiation. But one thing is that patents are presumed to be valid until they're invalidated. So during the negotiation, you should always understand your patent is valid until it's invalidated. And I would say that in the negotiation. One of the things about prior artists, you need to analyze the buyer's motivation. Why are they bringing up prior art? In some cases, they'll bring up prior art at the end of the negotiation. They'll ask for claim charts. You go through that and then they'll bring up prior art. The question is, why would they bring up prior art after they reviewed your claim charts. Why wouldn't they want to bring it up first? The buyer's motivation of using prior art against you is brought up at any point during the negotiation. So one of the things we want to do is analyze the buyer's motivation in terms of when they're bringing up prior art and why they're bringing it up. Sometimes they're bringing it up just to let you know that there's some negative opportunity on their end to say no. Sometimes they're bringing it up because it's absolutely a killer argument. There's no way they're going to buy this patent because of the prior art. So you have to kind of analyze where they are. Prior art doesn't mean the game is over. It could just be a negotiation tactic. One of the things is that sometimes buyers will say they have prior art, but they withhold it. And this is number 9, withholding prior art. If they withhold it and don't give it to you, like don't give you a patent number, that says that they probably really don't believe in the prior art. Once again, it's a negotiation. So I strongly suggest trying to get the prior art and asking them for it. If they don't give it to you and they're trying to shut you down for it, that's really setting you up for the question, should we assert our patent on these people because they're not being straightforward? Tell us what prior art they found. And I mentioned this before, but number 10, recognize all patents are prior art. So, of course, it's going to come up in every single deal that you have. One of the things you want to do in point number 11 is to try to highlight the differences between your patent and the prior art so you can have that discussion. There's always a difference. One of the things is there's always other consideration in prior art. Like sometimes prior art with the patent office gets discussed, like in office actions, and you overcome the prior art because you can show the examiner it wouldn't be that obvious to have this patent as prior art. So there's great objections on overcoming prior art based upon non-obviousness. Well, you don't see the connection. And finally, a couple more points. You can take a look at number 13 to explore different claim elements because it's prior art against a claim. But your patent has maybe 25 claims. So which claims is it that there's prior art against? Sometimes you have a system claim and a method claim. It may be prior art against a system claim, but not against a method. Sometimes a patent could have prior art at a broad level. So your first claim maybe gets invalidated, but your second claim, which is a dependent claim off the first, would not. You see, patents get allowed with something that an improvements to the claim. So you have a first claim, a second claim, a third claim. So a more narrow claim could be what they're doing, and that doesn't have prior art on it. Only the broadest claim has prior art on it. So explore claim amendments and figure out not only what prior art it is, but what claim is it against. And finally, one thing you can do, if it's a big enough deal, is you can request your own reexamination. And you can use the patents or the prior art they've given you and request a reexamination. If you came back with a reexamination that was positive, then you've got a great case for a patent sale. Unfortunately, reexaminations cost a lot of money and a lot of time. They could take 6-9 months plus hundreds of thousands of dollars. But if it's a big enough deal, you might decide to do that. Well, we've covered a lot in the topic 3 and topic 4, but let's move on. Topic number 5 and topic number 6 is coming up. We're going to learn about how to sell your patents to small companies. We're going to learn about why that makes a difference. We're going to learn about how, when you see a company, the post-financing of that company may make them a great target to buy your patents. We're going to talk about selling patents to small companies because it helps you amplify the value to them because maybe their stock value can go up. We're going to talk about additionally, after we talk about small companies and why they're such a great candidate to sell patents, we're going to talk about something really important, which is what happens if I've got 20, 30 companies and 2 or 3 contacts per company and I want to get out to that market. That's a pretty big chore to do. And we want to talk about certain things you could do to automate that process to make your life easier on the sale of your patents in a large market. So stay tuned for topic number 5 and topic number 6. Topic number 5, how to sell your patents. Consider selling your patents to small companies. And here are some of the reasons why. And by the way, I have practical experience doing this. Whenever I'm trying to sell patents or license patents, this always comes up. And I always have to convince my client about why they want to sell patents to a small company. Let's get right into it. Well, first of all, what do I mean by small company? I would say it's somewhere between $1 million and $100 million. $100 million may sound like a lot of money, but companies that have market caps of today, like Apple, almost $4 trillion, $100 million is small. So basically, and now I'm talking about market caps. So the company could have $5 million in cash, would be a $100 million market cap. So generally, small companies, $1 million, $100 million, particularly even small private companies or small public companies, they make great opportunities for selling your patent. Now, what are some of the reasons why small companies are good? Well, one of the great things about small companies is there's few gatekeepers. Getting into Apple or getting into Microsoft or to Samsung or to Hyundai or something is very difficult. There's a huge organization there, and how to get in and how to have them make decisions quickly just doesn't happen. So small companies, by the way, you might get right in and talk to the CEO, which would be wonderful, or at least talk to the CTO. So chances are one of the nice things is you can get through gatekeepers. Another reason why you want to potentially deal with small companies is, in topic number two, is even though they have fewer gatekeepers, number three is they're very less sophisticated analyzing patents. In a large company, they have teams of people who might analyze inbound patent opportunities. But in a small company, it's probably the CEO and maybe an outside attorney that's going to help make that decision. So even though there's less gatekeepers, also there's less sophistication to analyze it. Now, am I saying that there's a better opportunity to sell patents to people that don't know that much about patents? Absolutely yes. And believe it or not, I've seen a lot of transactions where people bought patents and then recognized what they really had bought was not what they thought they had bought. And so what we want to do is take the opportunity. If someone wants to buy a patent from you for the price that you want to sell it to, and they don't know all about why it's good or not, that's on them, right? So less sophistication. Topic number four is that there are many different options to buy patents when you're a small company. So maybe they can give you cash, but they can also give you equity. Now, large companies aren't going to give you equity. They can give you a percentage of sales. They can really buy your patent for some amount and say, I'll give you a percentage of the sales for the first 2 years. So it's an acquisition license. So there's so many things that can happen. They may decide, we'll buy your patent, but we want to hire you as a consultant for $150,000 a year, part-time, to help us deploy this invention. So now you're getting money for consulting. You're maybe getting money on the upside of equity. You're getting money for the sale. So there's so many other fungible ways to make money from small companies that there's always a much more creative deal to be made. One of the things about small companies is they usually have a small board. They have a few investors, and they're very worried about lawsuits. Unlike large companies who really don't care about patent lawsuits, they're like, sue me, try it. I have millions of dollars. You go find millions of dollars to sue me. Small companies don't want to be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars protecting themselves or even millions. So the fear of lawsuits is very big in small companies. So therefore, there's another reason why they want to buy patents. The other thing I mentioned is not only can you get through the gatekeepers, but number six is you can very quickly get through the right person, but you can very quickly from there get to the decision maker. And normally the decision maker is the CEO and the board. And anything above a certain amount, generally the CEO can, do. It's $500,000, $250,000, but the CEO, probably with the board, has a charter that says he doesn't make business transaction decisions if it's above, say, $5 million. So at some point you may find yourself in front of the board. But that's it. I mean, you're within two jumps to the top decision makers. One of the things that's great about small companies is that if you found out they just got a financing, or they just got $20 million financing for something, they have this money in the treasury, and generally most small companies, $1 million, $100 million, don't have a very good idea of the use of funds. They have some idea, but not detail. And we've done a lot of transactions where all of a sudden there was a round of funding. We came in to sell the patents, and the CEO thinks because he has money in his treasury, he really wants to buy this patent, he buys it. When I first started my first company, IP Capital, raised a bunch of money. As a CEO, it was amazing to me how many employees came to me wanting to do new things that we hadn't even dreamed of. One employee said, well, we should put it in the shower because I can run at lunch and spend more time at the office, so I should spend $20,000 and put a shower in. I mean, is that sort of thinking, right? That CEOs with new money feel a little bit flush in the pocketbook than they might spend the money. One of the things with small companies is the motivation to buy patents is also high because they can leverage it a lot. Buying a patent or two or three, they can leverage it a lot in their markets. They can put it on their website, put it in their marketing, use it with customers, use it with the board, use it with the press. And you see, a large company buying your patent wouldn't do any of those things. So there's so much extra things that a small company could do buying a patent. It's big news. And the other thing is that small companies have a way when they buy patents to amplify their own value. It turns them into, if they don't have any patents, now they do, and that gives them credibility. Now note, earlier I said, don't go to a company if they don't have their own patents. However, nothing's black and white here. I would say if they don't have their own patents, that's a negative to start with. But if they're a small company and they have money, that's a good market, okay, because of all the things we just mentioned. So it's very difficult for a large company to amplify the value because they already got multi-billion dollar markets and your patent is not going to move the needle. Well, on a small company, your patent could be a brand new product that could double their revenues. So there's always a different way with small companies. So please consider small companies when you're trying to sell your patent. Well, let's move on to topic number 6. How to sell your patents using the power of automation. Now, I thought about whether I should really put this in the podcast because for a number of years, we've applied automation to the sale of patents or the license for patents. And one of the things that we recognized over the years, I ran a licensing company and sold it a number of years ago, and we were doing lots of transactions with licensing executives, and we sold a lot of patents. And through the process of selling and licensing lots of patents, we had to get efficient at it. So there's all sorts of things we did to automate. Automated how to evaluate how the quality of the patent. Automate who might buy the patent. Automate how to find the gatekeepers. Automate how to reach to the gatekeepers. All these things are processes that take time. And we figured out a way to automate it. And we still do that today. But I'd like to touch on some of the automation that you yourself could do and think about. So number 2 is think about automating the identification of interests of companies. Like when you look at your patent, who would be interested? Some quick things you could do is look up citations. We've talked about this earlier in part 1. You know, who's citing your patent? What are those companies? Then you could pretty easily get on the internet and ask Chat Bing or something, or Google, what are competitors of that company? So now you've got your cited companies and you have competitors' companies. You can even put your patent in to these large language model chat tools and basically say, who would be representative companies that we could sell this to? So automate the practice of figuring out which companies we could sell to. So number 3 is automate the extraction of company contacts. So we have a company. You should figure out the types of people you want to find those companies. And you can use a web crawler or do a lot of work on the internet to try to find these names, if you will. There's probably some AI programs, et cetera, that you could go to find the right names in the company. There are definitely data services like ZoomInfo and the rest, but that costs a lot of money. We have these accounts. We offer these services to our clients, but you want to figure out a way to automate how to get as many names as possible. And once you do that, then the next part is to understand how to get their emails. And so that's yet another AI tool or whatever. But automating getting the contact names and their emails is extremely important. You could get their phone numbers, but I can tell you over the years, dialing somebody on the phone just is so difficult. So we almost totally rely on emails today. The next thing is, once you have companies and you have the contacts and you have the emails, you want to, number 4, figure out what the marketing package is. And finding a way to automate that, you see, you might develop a marketing package basically to describe your patent and the market, your case, your video, and all that stuff that we just mentioned. But any marketing package really needs to be customized for every single buyer because you have to know what's specific to them about your patent that they would want. That's the hook. So figure out a way to automate that. There are AI programs today that can help you very quickly dump in, say, the content of your patent, the content of their website, and have the large language model come up with the connections, if you will. So automating that is an important thing. One of the things we want to sort of think about is number 5, automating the sequence of emails. Once again, there are tools you can buy that are expensive, thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to do an email sequence. Because if you've got to do 30 companies with 3 contacts each, that's 100 emails. And you want to put a sequence of emails out to get the attention. So you're tracking a lot of stuff. And like I mentioned, we do some of these things as a service. I even wrote my own email sequencer because I do it so much. But clearly there are ways that you might find some tools to help you through the email sequencing. One of the things that would help in number 6 is automate the review of the outreach results. By that I mean, as you start to get results in, most people don't recognize that the results, when they say something or say nothing or make statements, all that is data to help you analyze the responses to the market. It's like customer feedback, right? So If you can have a structured way of taking information in from everybody you talk to and have a way to analyze it, you can actually automate it. So what we do is we have all sorts of ways to analyze it, the click rate, the reply rate. We have checklists when we talk to people about whether they talk about prior art, et cetera, et cetera. So you can automate. But let's just say that everybody you talk to is talking about the price being too high, but nobody's talking about prior art. You might not think about that, but that's very valuable information. Next thing you want to do is number 7 is to automate how you do the interaction with the client. If you sort of think about it, the very first time somebody would respond to an email is great. The first time you get them on the phone or through a Zoom, et cetera, is the next step. So what do you do in a way, because you're going to be handling many of these calls, right, and many of these Zooms. So what can you do to have a format? What can you do to have questions and answers and really kind of automate this whole interaction? And then it turns out that a lot of the deals that we've looked at over the years, on the first reach outs to 30, 50, 100 companies, we didn't get as much a response. Well, what we recognized, and this is all serendipitous, that 6 months or a year later, sometimes we get emails from some of the clients that said no, to now the client saying, can I get in touch with that inventor that owns a patent if it's still for sale? Because now we have an interest. Well, what's up with that? Well, what's up with that is that now that they understood the patent, maybe they didn't have a need for it, but then something happens in the market and they say, Jesus, if we'd had that patent, if we'd had that direction, we could use it. So you should automate this whole ability. If you're not successful in the first round, maybe 6 months or a year and a half or 2 years, automate a trigger to re-respond out. And number 9 is, if all that sounds like too much work, you don't have to worry, because there are firms out there that can help with that whole automation. Now, some of these firms like to take back-end upside for it. Some firms want to get some consulting fees for it. Some want both. So you should kind of pick and choose your automation partner if you do. But if you don't have time, but you think your patent is valuable, I'd strongly recommend that you go after an automation partner. So let's wrap up. In topic number 1, we talked about the top 10 things to avoid. I mean, we talked about selling patents with avoiding legal complications, you know, title. We talked about things like expiration dates. We talked about things like mistakes that you could make by finding companies that don't have enough funds, that don't understand patents, etc. We talked about declaratory judgments and avoiding those. We talked about somehow making sure that your patents are in the same headquarters as the buyer, because that's important. We talked about things like how to make sure that you're ready to share know-how, and how to make sure that with the inventors on the patents, that they're still with the company, hopefully, or at worst, they're not renegade inventors, because that'll make everything very complicated. In topic number 2, we talked about how to sell patents in terms of the 10 best practices to improve the chances of sale. We talked about things like inventing around your patent or on top of your patent. We talked about ways to innovate and file multiple additions to your patents. We talked about ways to demonstrate the improvement that you have, the ongoing improvement. We talked about key trade secrets that you might want to add. We talked about adding prototypes. We talked about connection IP. We talked about how to spark interest and getting good at understanding what the file wrapper said. And we talked about how to do compelling videos, and also how to highlight the value across relevant markets. And no matter what, how to try to rationalize that the cost invested in your patent is a big opportunity for someone when they buy the patent to get all that essential investment in the patent. In topic number 3, we talked about evidence of use. And this one, always want to be careful of, right? We talked about how evidence of use by definition invalidates your patent. And so the evidence of use, basically, if your patent is valid, is a marker that says that the buyer might be using your patent. We talked about the declaratory judgment issue once again, because now it's more highlighted in things like patent infringement. We talked about the evidence of use of not only the company you're selling it to, but to their competitor, and how to use that as a trading card. We talked about claim charts and how to make sure they were accurate and find the right entities that helped with the right claim charts. We found that how this strongly helps negotiation power if you have evidence of use, right? And we also talked about the perceived value, because if you have evidence of use, the market value is certainly higher. It shows that it's in the market, that people are actually doing it. And also we said that if you get evidence of use, they have to do more due diligence by definition because they don't want to get sued. And that's what you want. You want any company that might want to buy your patent to do really good due diligence because they become interested as they do more due diligence. In topic number four, we talked about what happens when the buyer says, hey, you know what? Your patent's invalid. It happens a lot. Okay, what does that actually mean? Well, we talked about invalidity means that if they have prior art, if that prior art was available for the examiner, they wouldn't have issued your patent. So if that prior art becomes available after the examiner allowed it, it could be used to invalidate your patent through reexamination. But you know what? If all of a sudden, you know, the buyer claims your patent's invalid, there's a lot you can do. You can strengthen your position here by understanding the prior art yourself, by understanding through a legal opinion whether or not the prior art is really good prior art or not. We also know that it's not just a prior art against your patent claim, but it's all claims. And you may have many claims in the patent that is not invalid. And so you should go down that road as well. We talked about how to talk about the unique aspects of your patent claims and how it could be that you yourself might tell them that even though you have some claims that don't appear to be invalid, it turns out that those claims are the most valuable part of the invention. And we also talked about strategies like you understanding the complexity of the prior art enough to understand the type and so on to actually use that in the negotiation. And finally, we said at the end of the day, you might decide to do your own reexamination. In topic number five, we talked about consider selling to a small company, and there are many good reasons why. I mean, we talked about there's fewer gatekeepers. We talked about it's easy to get the decision makers, more easy than a large company. We talked about there's all sorts of things to negotiate, you know, equity and consulting fees and things. We talked about how small companies can really amplify the value of doing a sale. We talked about small companies probably don't have the expertise that large company does, and maybe in this case, no expertise is going to help you sell the patent. Also, we talked about how you can do all sorts of, you know, deals with small companies that a large company would never do. So think about small companies as a class of potential buyers. And finally, we ended up in topic number six, talk about all those steps about automation, you know, how to find the right companies, how to find the right names, how to get their emails, how to build a marketing package that's unique to each potential buyer, how to then automate the process of sequences of emails and to get to them, how to automate getting them on the phone or the Zoom call for the first time, how to collect and analyze their data so that you really know what's going on, and finally, how to use that in the negotiation. And then at the end, we said many deals might not happen in the time you want, but don't forget re-engaging a sale package 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years. Many times we've done deals years after we started because all of a sudden the market wakes up and decides to need your patent. So we hope this podcast helped with these six different topics. If you like this, please subscribe at the bottom. And come join us at our blog, Invent Anything. And also take a listen to our new podcast series on Inventors at Work. This is John Cronin, Invent Anything.